Well, we need to decide what we're going to do for the next while. Shall we do that first, or think that's a good idea? Who has? I see you have an interesting idea.
I've got something. I don't know if you've done this before.
I don't think we have.
This is a Red Pine translation of the putative teachings of Bodhidharma, but nobody really knows what it.
Nobody agrees whether we really.
Putative or not, or something.
Yeah.
What is
putative?
What does it mean? What are you talking
about?
What's the book?
Oh. Oh, that teaching of Bodhidharma, this is translated by Red Pine, so it's some texts that are purportedly, that's why I said putative. Supposedly they were talks to about Bodhidharma. But, you know, because the whole question of the historical existence of Bodhidharma and whether he actually gave these or whether somebody else at some time or place blew him down, there's some uncertainty about that.
But it's still
really pretty cool. I've gone through them a few times. But
I think some of that material is supposed to be more authentic than other parts of it, but the authenticity isn't so important. It's the truth of it that matters.
Yeah.
So, and there's it's good.
It's they're really pretty far out.
Are there other suggestions? Yes.
Several months ago, when we were up sitting at your place, you had a book that you had just received in the mail from Tegan Stevens, and you were reading it. Was that, would that be something that would be worthwhile to go through, or were there? Isn't it a book of questions that?
That's what he called it. It was really a book of his little talks to his group. So it's sort of like. I think I'd feel like I was giving Dharma talks about Dharma talks in that case. It's a nice book. It's a very nice book, and it's got some good things in it. But I think for us to go into it is probably extra.
Is there any literature that you've been reading that's really talking to you in that way where you think maybe we would benefit? I mean, I there's this kind of democratic process of talking about things, but you yourself, have you read anything recently that it was like something pretty profound that maybe you hadn't seen in earlier readings for yourself?
Actually, except for the book about the women's practice that I've already sent away, but there's a wonderful book that Paula Arai wrote. She did an ethnological study of 10 years in Japan with women who practiced at a little Soto monastery, lay people, lay women. And she studied their lives and how they took Buddhism into their life and ritualized it in their own way and healed themselves in various ways from various kinds of suffering. So it's very interesting. Donna Lynn gave it to me. She gave it to me at Sesshin, and I just fell right into it. It was just perfect. It was so interesting. But I'm not sure that would be relevant either, though I recommend it to everybody.
What is the title and the author's name again?
Paula Arai, A-R-I. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
How about, you know, the John Dido Laurie compendium of the so-called the Dogen's collection of koans. Have you ever?
Yeah, that's a good book.
Yeah, it's pretty long.
It's very, it's really fat.
Really long.
Yeah.
I don't know if that fits in, well, a couple of things, since we haven't really particularly emphasized koans. Like, sometimes used to sit with a group that was affiliated with Pacific Center, whatever they call themselves now, you know, after that. And they were, we just picked one of those, you know, each evening.
Mm.
Those are pretty interesting, though. And they come up, of course, all of the time, and some of the other things that we've read.
In Dogen, for instance.
Like the Precious Mirror Samadhi.
Yes.
There's a koan about that. But what is?
Right.
I don't know. You know, it's just...
Well, the Soto school has a book of koans called The Book of Serenity, which is a nice one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we could do that.
I'm just throwing out anything.
Wendy?
Well, working off this list that Donna Lynn compiled, I was interested in the voices of the river, valley, and the form of the mountains.
That's a beautiful one.
Yeah, we've never really studied any perspective Dogen on nature.
That's a good one. Yeah, it's a beautiful one.
And it's only 6 pages.
That's a big plus.
Is it?
Yes, it would, Dogen.
Well, after the Diamond Sutra, I guess this really is a plus.
I'm still lost now.
We'll be lost forever.
I think I was kind of, I don't know what I was dreaming or hallucinating or what. I started thinking about it.
It's a dream. It's a dream. Well, we need to decide. So mountains and rivers, Bodhidharma. Book of Serenity, the koans and Book of Serenity.
Is that available? Is it privately published?
No, I have a copy of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure.
No, it's not privately published.
But can we get it online?
Probably.
Available.
I bet you can. I bet Amazon has it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are probably different versions, wouldn't you think, of it? Different translations? Or?
It could be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can look into that. All right, are you thinking?
Run over that, too. Oh, gosh.
One over,
okay. Oh, that's too many. Those John Cleese books when he mixes up his R's and W's.
Yes.
Are you our John Cleese? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, dear.
I'm a horrible person, I admit it.
Who votes for mountains and rivers?
Can
we vote twice?
Well, let's vote through once and see what we've got. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yes.
Who votes for a Bodhidharma?
That's not the koan. Okay.
And who votes for the koan? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
She said I've been run over.
It's 2 years.
I've been run over by a Dharma wheel.
Two years worth. Yeah.
Yeah. can make a copy of it for you.
Well, we can do this some other time, too.
Sure. Sure, it'll wait for us. It's been waiting for thousands of years, so. So, I got an assignment last week from Samia, who suggested that the topic of pain would be helpful. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought how helpful a topic it is. And I'm very glad you thought of it. Of course, it's the original teaching of Buddha. The Four Noble Truths is that pain exists, suffering exists, dissatisfaction exists, and that translation is more accurate to the Pali and the Sanskrit that it comes to us from. So it isn't about physical pain. It's about the pain that we add to the pain. So if we have stubbed our toe, it's one thing. It's an experience without a judgment on it. But then when we get mad about it and hurt about it and want it to go away and add all these other things to it, the dissatisfaction is what creates this other kind of suffering. So Buddha's whole teaching was about how our mind works, how it quickly leaps at each experience and tries to turn it into something else. Tries to turn it into something about me. You know, I don't like to have a stubbed toe. It's not fair. Or why is it happening to me and not somebody else? I mean, you hear that sometimes, you know. And we feel that. It just seems so unfair. And yet the story of our life is that we're this soft little creature full of a whole nervous system that is designed especially to feel pain in order to help us get through the hard, sharp things of the world. If we didn't feel it, and some people are born without being able to, they are in terrible danger. They burn themselves, they put their hand in the fire, and they don't take it out because they don't feel it. So it's a gift to us, a big gift. But it's not personal. It isn't that we hurt because there's some meanie out there somewhere doing it to us. It's that we're soft and full of nerves and we're subject to our own evolution, you could say, and also the pull of the earth. The earth is pulling on us all the time. Gravity is holding us. And as we sit zazen, already we feel discomfort because in our usual day and night, we turn and move and shift constantly. We don't even know we're doing it. But we cannot sit very, very still without beginning to really hurt. So we're really hurting all the time, but we're really moving to have another kind of hurt and another kind of hurt. In the National Geographic once, there was a series of photographs that somebody took of a woman sleeping in her bed. And she said, I never move when I sleep. I just put my head down and I'm like that all night. And then they showed her and it looked like she was dancing. She was this way and that way and up, all over the place all night long. She was turning and turning and turning. We all do that. So it's how we deal with the ordinary, everyday kind of pain. But of course, we have other kinds of pain. And I think that's what Sami is talking about, perhaps, is the extra pain that comes when we stub our toe or develop arthritis or tweak our back or have a whole series of headaches, or psychically when we go through eras in our life that are really, really difficult. And although it's not visible, you can't put a bandage on it, you sure can feel it. So I brought a couple of things that I thought were interesting on this subject, including something that Paula Arai said. The things that have helped me. I've had a lot of pain, both kinds, in my life. And it's always been a very interesting subject to me, how we, what we give to ourselves in order to bear our life. So one of the things that she discovered was that beauty was a big subject for the women that she was studying. And she said, being in the presence of beauty heals by nourishing. The power seems to lie in the experience of receiving the energy of beauty. When pain fills you, receiving input from other sources does not take the pain away, but it gives you more to feed on than the pain. So in the case of the women in Japan, they would, in cherry blossom time, if they were in mourning, they would just go out and walk under the cherry blossoms and just delight in the beauty of them. And it would take away their self-absorption, which is really what this is all about. If we're so self-absorbed, then pain builds, and it becomes the whole subject. And so the trick is to find other subjects that are more interesting, more real, and more nourishing, as she says, that expand our life and our view rather than narrowing it. And of course, what we tend to do is to get more and more narrow and move less and go out less and just it's easy to end up feeling sorry for myself when it gets really, really rough. So that's one thing, is just beauty. And it doesn't have to be glorious cherry blossoms either. It could be something very simple. I have, Ritu has seen it, the scrapbook that I bring to the women's writing retreat every year. It's about this thick now. I've kept it for probably 30 years. And I've just collected anything that attracted me, anything that I like to see. Sometimes it was poems, little poems that I found, or beautiful etching that was in a magazine, or an ancient statue, or pictures my kids made. Every kind of thing, but anything that really resonated in me that I would want to see again and that would cheer me up. And remind me that there's more to the world than my own little pips and squeaks. So that's been very helpful. And anything like that is, I mean, you might not want a scrapbook like mine, but you might have it full of NASCAR racers or something entirely different. But all of those, all of the beauty part, the art part, the music part, the part that the other parts of our brain, if you study the neurological things, that the arts especially are in a whole nother way that we think. So it expands our view just by turning on another part of our brain. And I think, especially if we're in some kind of physical pain or difficulty, that it's easy to get obsessed by it and make it the whole subject. And so whatever we can do to change the subject, which means change the mind, it's very, very helpful. Our physical constitution is such that even the cells of our body work better if we have peace of mind. Whereas an agitated mind usually brings some physical imbalance. If peace of mind is important for good health, that means the body itself is structured in a way that accords with mental peace. Therefore, we can say that human nature is more inclined to gentleness and affection. Even our body's structure seems designed not for fighting, but for embracing. Look at our hands. If they weren't meant for hitting, I think they would be hard like a hoof. The Dalai Lama said that. So the trick is to weave the pain into the rest of our life and not let it be the main subject. That's certainly what I have been trying to do. With age, pain just naturally, often, not always, but often becomes a bigger subject, and it takes more self-care in order to be with it, and yet most of the self-care is finding ways of being with it and not being stymied by it and blocked by it and made to feel helpless by it, which means loving our body. Sometimes the body becomes a kind of enemy if it's in pain. You know, you think, oh, this is bad. This bad body, it's giving me such a hard time. And of course that's absurd, because that is me. I learned it in the hospital once, when I had a surgery many years ago and woke up in pain one night and nobody was coming to help me, and I just held myself in my arms and rocked myself, and I said to my body, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. And it made everything so much better. It was just all one thing that was happening then. So I recommend that part especially. Just to really feel gratitude for the body, that it's still working in some way, even though it's not working the way we want it to. It's us. There's much to be grateful for. Dogen said, in the total body, there is no obstruction. It is graciously smooth and tumbles freely. In the total body, there is no obstruction. It is graciously smooth and tumbles freely. This body is a part of a much greater body. And when we sit, we're often available to that knowledge. And we can be available at all times, including in the times that we're really suffering. We're not alone. One practice that goes with the Tonglen practice is to remember that if you're feeling bad in one way, that there must be thousands of people with this very same problem. Thousands of them. My back hurts. Well, probably somebody right down the street has a hurting back at the same time. Those things are so common, but even the uncommon ones. We're a family, and we're all suffering together. And yet the whole body of us is tumbling freely, just as we live and breathe. So one of the things that Paula Rai came up with was how impressed she was with how the women that she studied created rituals around their lives that weren't exactly real Soto Zen rituals, although that was their practice. They made it to fit their own lives so that they had maybe an altar and a way of going to the altar first thing in the morning, which created not only peace for them, but for the whole family. And she would chant the Heart Sutra, one of them. And then all the kids getting ready for school and the husband and all of them, they were all hearing it. They weren't doing it with her, but it was all part of the household. One woman who lived alone would call out to her dead sister saying, "I'm home," because her dead sister had become a Buddha for her. And she thought of her as always being there and always being protective of her. There were a number of these little rituals that they made up for themselves, for their own healing, for making the pain take its rightful place. So that's what I've been ruminating on in response to Samya's question. And I know you all must have something much to add to this, because we all have problems and we all have ways of dealing with it too. So
I wanted to talk a little bit about ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And about the ones that you make up. Things that help me with my practice and always keep it as much as I can. And one of those, I have a problem with compassion for really poor drivers. This has for a long time been a real problem for me. It seems to trigger tremendous anger that I have no idea where this stuff is deposited. But it'll trigger it, it'll come up. So I realized I had reached a time in my life when I needed to do something. I needed to really do something, or something that I would, the karma of which I was not willing to wreak, because
I knew there was something for me to do. So one of the things I did is I made a little altar in that cigarette area of most automobiles. I've got a little. And then I have a little card that tells me what I need to be doing. And it has helped me so much. I must have done that about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been extremely helpful. Very, very helpful. Because of the time of days, and I'm usually on the road, which is periods in which there's a lot of people on the road, and there's a lot of driving activity that just will send my blood pressure through the roof.
Yeah.
And it's a reminder.
Yeah.
When I come to that stop sign, and I'm having to remind myself that I don't have to go chasing after that blithering idiot. And so that's one thing. Another thing is when I'm in my automobile and I drive by and I see a dead animal, I'm reminded, I say a little kind of prayer for whether it's sin or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that's really helpful because there was a lot of things that on this day have passed. They've been run over, they fell off something.
Yeah.
And that's very helpful for my practice. It keeps my heart tender.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing that I find helpful. Those are two little rituals in my automobile. So, and you can come out and look at my little altar.
That's wonderful.
Anyway, I just wanted to
say that. Thank you, Jeffrey. Keeping the heart tender is a really good point. And that's something that gets covered over often in painful times. It's like we're protecting ourselves and gritting our teeth and trying so hard and feeling so beset. And that's the very time when the real tenderness and woundedness of us can help us so much. But it takes something to remind us often. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. That's exactly right. I have a friend who always carried a shovel in the back of his car, and he buries the animals. He'll get right out on the freeway and rescue a skunk or something.
It doesn't sound too wise.
No, but it's very compassionate.
I know, but is that his life?
Well, that's the kind of guy he is.
Who's going to shovel it up?
Well, he's made it so far.
What I see expressed by humans.
Yes.
You know, as often as people may have physical afflictions, it's primarily their mental afflictions that are expressed towards me, or that I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that feeling of compassion, the Tongan practice. Mm-hmm. When somebody is depressed, you know there's millions of Americans that are depressed.
Oh, yeah.
When you have something close to home that might be like anxiety, you realize that a lot of people feel anxiety in this society. Mm-hmm. And my practice provides me that ballast so that I don't succumb to that depression. Or that anxiety.
Yeah.
It's one of the great beauties of what we do. And it's that you begin with gratitude that your practice affords you how to walk upright, and just, you know, not bend your head over. So why that goes on in this culture?
Yes.
People who are beaten
and scared.
Just
yeah.
I think part of it, and I'm really pretty bad at this, is just learning to be kind to yourself, because a lot of the stuff that comes up, you know, you see other people, they're either stressed out, or they're belligerent, or they're tense, or rude, or whatever, and you react. I mean, I work in a high-tech company, and people rush me out all day, you know. A lot of them seem
yeah.
happy in different ways, and sometimes it bothers me, but I do. And I get the same way different times, you know. But I'm not really very good at it, but I think a few years ago I finally figured that I try to just cut myself more slack, and instead of being so compulsive about everything and always saying, oh, I've got to, you know, I've got to get this done, or do this, I have to accomplish, do this today, or, you know, it has to be this way or not, you know. Try to kind of back off from that a little bit and just say, well, I've done what I could.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, you know, it's got to be good enough.
Take it easy.
Yes, take it easy.
And that kind of, you know, that rubs off on other people. Too.
It does.
I mean, because that's, you know, you're not just showing compassion for yourself, but I think if you can develop that a little bit, then it's easier to show compassion for others, you know, instead of just getting reacting, you know,
yes.
to their situation or pushing it back out to them.
Right. There was a man at the spot meeting this weekend who was telling about when he got in the construction business, which is what he does. He works building houses and whatever else needs to be done. And he was just a part of the gang, and he said they're all foul-mouthed and braggarts and tough and fighting, and, you know, it's just a bunch of guys who are really macho. And he was that way too until he started sitting. And then he said he began to realize that there was more to those people than he was knowing. And he could see how vulnerable they really were, and how afraid and how tender, and it just completely changed his whole understanding of the people he was working with and himself. He thought, wow, I'm like that too. I'm just showing off to them. And they're showing off to me. And what is this about? So it's interesting when you become paying attention, not just to yourself, as you say, but you begin to understand about other people too, and then the whole thing begins to shift. Very interesting. Yeah. Well, it's after 8. It's quite after 8, actually. Apologize. Thank you for bringing up the subject. So I'll bring the Book of Serenity next week. Shall I do that? or I'll bring the Dogen one too.
Angie,
yes.
Is it possible we could post on the site which translation you're going to be bringing in?
Sure.
Great.
I could let you know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Should we have our 1 minute sit? A quick minute?